Monitoring a Heartbeat in Mercer's Hospital, Dublin, 1983. And Mercer's Hospital 250 years ago.
Whereas Mary Mercer, of the city of Dublin, spinster, being piously and charitably inclined to build, at her own charge, a house for the reception of 20 poor girls or other poor persons, proposed to build the same in the parish of St. Peter's, in the suburbs of the city of Dublin, provided the said parish would set out to the said Mary...
The founding of Mary Mercer's legacy, a home for girls on a site that had once housed lepers and was once a churchyard. That was 259 years ago, and 10 years later...
She, the said Mary, by the advice and approbation of the said minister, churchwardens and parishioners, was disposed to settle and convert the said stone house or messuage for the accommodation and use of such poor persons as may happen to labour under diseases of tedious and hazardous cure, such as the falling sickness, lunacy, leprosy, and such other diseased or infirm poor persons as the trustees named by her, and such other trustees as should from time to time be nominated...
Thus, Mercer's Hospital was founded with 10 beds in 1734. And there, strangely enough, ends the story of Mary Mercer and the hospital which has borne her name for almost 250 years. She died in 1735, the year after the hospital opened, and left not a penny of her £6,000 fortune to the hospital.
The bulk of her fortune went to found a hospital, a school for girls, Mercer's School for Girls, which was in Castle Knock. So the governors were left to find the monies.
And find them they did, largely through benefit concerts and musical evenings.
But of course the most important association is with the Messiah.
And from that first performance of Messiah, Mercer's got £127.
A lottery was a regular thing. And then, of course, there were other ways. The St. Helen's Fete, a raffle for a black pig. And then there was Lady Wheeler's ingenious mile of half crowns.
What was the status of Mercer's at the time?
It was one of the first of the voluntary hospitals. The first in Dublin was the charitable infirmary, and the second was Dr. Stephen's Hospital. Now Mercer's was the third.
Medical historian Professor J.B. Lyons.
In the year 1736, the ladies who worked here were known as nurse keepers. They weren't qualified nurses as such. In actual fact, the ladies who were employed were women of low character because they regarded nursing the sick as a humiliating condition.
And in 1738, this nurse keeper blotted her copybook, and it was ordered
that Alice McCann be carried before the Lord Mayor to be punished for seducing the patients in the house, and that she be discharged the service of the house.
And she was given 18 shillings and sixpence for her troubles.
But she wasn't the only one to break the rules. In 1739...
A great quantity of medicines and drugs belonging to the house were stolen, with a large quantity of old linen, by James Dunn and Eleanor Ware, who have made their escape and absconded to avoid due punishment. It be an instruction to the surgeons not to appoint any nurse for this hospital under the age of 40 years.
The matron at the time was bound by certain conditions.
To have no followers, and be able to read and write, and to see that the beds are filled with fresh straw every 2 months, and that each bed be provided with clean sheets every month or oftener if required, and to see that each nurse do return the foul sheets for the clean ones, and to see that the nurses keep their wards clean, and the sick and maimed committed to their care clean, to see that the bandages be washed and made clean against the time the surgeons come to dress their patients.
And all for £8 a year. In 1794, the governors issued this ultimatum.
Ordered positively that no sand for the future, on any account whatever, be strewed on the floor of the wards, passages, stairs, hall, etc., of this hospital, the surgery excepted. Any officer or servant transgressing this order to be dismissed.
That brings us to a curious entry in the minute book of the 21st of April, 1739.
Whereas by sticking candles to ye bedsteads, the beds and house are frequently in danger of being burned. Ordered, that all ye marks of fire now on several of ye bedsteads be scraped off, and yet every morning for ye future, ye housekeeper do view ye several beds, and if she finds ye mark of fire on any of ye bedsteads, that she immediately examine into ye cause or author of it, and complain to the surgeon in attendance, who is desired immediately to dismiss ye person who was discovered to do it.
It was left to the clerk of the day to carry out these dismissals. Today, the administrator of Mercer's Hospital is called the secretary. Joseph P. Little, a chartered accountant, has held the office for the past 37 years and is now retiring. What was it like 37 years ago?
Oh, it was very different in those days. I mean, the staff, especially, you know, that's particularly noticeable, the explosion in staff numbers, you know. And, of course, there was an addition also to the hospital in 1957, I think it was. Maybe it was a bit earlier than that, 1954 possibly, when they built a nurse's home.
Where were the nurses housed before that?
And that they were, some of them were housed actually in the hospital, and then the old nurse's home, which was, of course, very overcrowded then. And it was because of the overcrowding that they decided to build a new home.
How many patients approximately were here when you took over?
There's not a great difference in the number of beds available. I think there have only been about 8 beds added between the time I came and now. We opened an intensive care unit, which was a very important thing. We had none at that time.
It was a very old building. It must have had its problems, had it, trying to manage in a building that was really outdated long before you took over.
No, indeed it was, yes, yes.
Were you aware of the need to move on at a very early stage?
Not at a very early stage, no. That was much later when hospital equipment becomes so much more expensive. I mean, it was obvious to everybody you couldn't be duplicating expensive equipment over a number of small hospitals, and it seemed a rational thing then to have a larger institution.
Money has always been a problem for hospitals.
Oh, indeed it has, yes, yes.
Did you think it strange in a way that hospitals didn't opt for the sweepstakes method of financing at the beginning? That it took them a while to sort of cotton on to it?
Yes. This hospital was the didn't participate for, I think, a couple of years after the sweepstake started. Of course, I wasn't here at that time. But I think they were had some moral reservations about participation in a sweepstake.
Training for nursing as a profession only became known in Ireland in 1890.
The matrons of the voluntary hospitals drew up and put into practice the first nursing science course for nurses at the Royal College of Surgeons.
Where would the matrons themselves have got their training?
In England, a lot of them got their training. Miss Huxley was trained in St. Thomas's in London, and she was matron of the Ioneer. And she was actually one of the matrons who started the first nursing science school in Ireland with assistance from the other matrons of the voluntary hospitals.
And where was that training actually undertaken?
It was undertaken at the Metropolitan School, it was known as, and then it was transferred to the Royal College of Surgeons in 1900. And the students then from the voluntary hospitals attended the College of Surgeons for their lectures. And the lectures were given by the Royal College, by the surgeons and physicians in the Royal College of Surgeons at that time.
So nursing then acquired a real status?
It did, yes. After 1919, the Legislation Act was brought in between England and Ireland, and nurses were registered under the 1919 Act, which was an Act of Parliament at Westminster. And then our own Act was brought in when On Board Alternates was established in 1950.
Here's how one student nurse at Mercer's in 1917 got her training.
We went out to lecture in rooms beyond the Shelbourne. I don't know what you call them. I don't know what the name of the place is. For anatomy, physiology, hygiene. And then there was an exam held in the College of Surgeons. And then we had, below the College of Surgeons, there were rooms where we had lectures for invalid cookery. And we had an exam there in the place at the end of the course of lectures, you know.
You had to do the cooking for invalids on special diets, had you?
Oh, no. No, no, no. But like if you went out private nursing or out, you know, on a district, you need to know for the patient. You want to know how to, well, to prescribe for a patient, you know.
Cookery of a fairly basic nature was the duty of matron in 1736.
To see that the cook does her duty and that she herself prepare the gruel or other preparations above the capacity of the common nurses.
Even in 1917, conditions were tough for the nurses. They had to work hard.
Well, she had to work hard. You never said, you could never be seen to sit down. Never. We didn't know how to sit down. Then you had to have the centre crease in the counterpane was straight between the toes of the patient at the end. And just here at the chest. And the clothes, I often pity the patients, the clothes were just right across here. And there was no covering on their shoulders at all. If they ruffled the bed enough to get the clothes over their shoulders, oh, they were lighted upon and made straight quiet. They were like blocks of wood in the bed, you know. And the matron is doing a round and staff or the surgeon is doing his round and you go around tidying beds and pulling them up and fixing them all day long. Oh, sure, I don't know. So much so that I think the patient didn't profit by their exactness and their red tape, too much red tape. Every Sunday morning, you'll be doing around 12 o'clock, we had brass caddies, the surgical dressings in, you know, and you'd be in the bathroom doing the brass caddies with bath brick. Bath brick we shone them up with, you know. And Christchurch bells, it started so lonely here. The Christchurch bells were so clear. They always connect the two things, doing those brasses and Christchurch bells.
Many famous medical men have worked in Mercer's Hospital during its long history.
One of these was George Daunt, sometimes spoken of as Dauntless Daunt. He was a genital urinary surgeon, and he devised an instrument for crushing bladder stones. Another of the censors was Gustavus Hume, who is remembered today for his association with Hume Street. He was a surgeon, but he also built houses on the side. And the third was Henry Morris.
To this group, Professor Thomas Gilmartin added,
we had Leonard Abrahamson, who was one of the most outstanding physicians of perhaps even of this century. He was a tremendous teacher. He was a pioneer in cardiology and started his work in cardiology in Mercer's. And strange to relate now, he was stimulated to do the work by Sir John Lumsden, who I think procured one of the first apparatus which is used, what's described as an electrocardiograph. He was able to provide Leonard Abrahamson with one through some funds that were at his disposal, and Abrahamson certainly pioneered cardiology, I think, in this country. Mercer's was then a hospital which was associated with great names both in medicine and surgery. I instance such people of international standing as, particularly Sir William Wheeler and Sir John Lumsden. He mightn't have the international name, but he was certainly one of the famous Irish doctors. He was a commissioner of the St. John's Ambulance Brigade, and he was probably the pioneer in industrial medicine in this country in his work at St. James's Gate at Guinness Brewery. Sir William Wheeler, his standards were that of the Mayo Clinic. And indeed, it's a great tribute to Mercer's that it contained his ambitions. He was, unfortunately, when he was a young man, he suffered an accident which resulted in him losing an eye. And that may have had an effect on his personality, that although he was a brilliant surgeon, he was a very irascible sort of person in the theatre. To give you an example of his avant-garde approach to surgery, I actually saw him, when I was a student, attempt the removal of a lung, that's a pneumonectomy. And at that time, there had been no successful pneumonectomy performed in the world that was known in the literature, known about in the literature, successful one, I mean. And the famous Sarbrook, who was eventually Hitler's surgeon, he was probably the greatest thoracic surgeon in the world. He had attempted five of this type of operation, and each patient, regrettably, died. Sir William Wheeler's case wasn't successful either, but he was prepared to make an attempt in any particular sphere of his work and lead the world if necessary.
Sir William de Courcy Wheeler, he was the bone specialist, and he did very, very fine operations. You know, TB vertebrae, took out the vertebrae and put in a replacement from a shin bone, you know.
As a physician, Sir John Lumsden was, as I say, the other notable figure in Mercer's. Sir John was a rather, I might say, he was a very debonair person. He was impeccably dressed always, had, of course, the perfect bedside manner, but was inclined towards the a sort of P.G. Woodhouse type of person who had sobriquets for everybody. Wheeler, for example, Sir William Wheeler was Billy, and Senator Rolette, who was another physician, colleague of his, was Rolly, and I, when he deigned to notice me, was Gilly. Gil Martin, as you know, is my name. He had an extraordinary faith in the product made in his famous firm, Guinness. And even in 1943, when he was writing about what the position was then in Guinness, he talked rather about in this sort of vein. He said that since the start of the war, there had been prescribing stout at the dispensary up in St. James's Gate in lieu of ordinary tonics, as drugs, he said, were in short supply. And he said, I have been struck by the admirable results which we have obtained. It is cheaper than medicines and in many cases gives much better results.
He was a character, wasn't he?
He was, yes. He was definitely a character. Then, on the other hand, we had Senator Robert J. Rolette, who was so ascetic that he never owned a motor car, and he was a tremendous person in politics. He was a great philosopher, a very liberal man, a tremendous doctor. He used to be described as the doctor's doctor.
Professor Thomas Gilmartin himself, now retiring after 50 years in Mercers, was the man who revolutionised anaesthesia in Ireland by bringing the wonder drug Curare to Dublin.
When I was appointed to the staff as an honorary anaesthetist, I realised that a lot of progress was necessary in this particular field. Because the mortality was very high, was quite high, and I believe that anaesthetics might have, or did, contribute a good deal to the mortality. But I was particularly stimulated by the fact that Mr. J.H. Cooligan had the prescience and indeed the courage to take up thoracic surgery. Very little of that work being done in Dublin at the time. Perhaps some in Baggot Street, in the city of Dublin, the Royal City of Dublin Hospital, and some in the Mater. But it wasn't being done in any very organised or specialised way. When Mr. Cooligan took up this very difficult branch of surgery, it meant that the anaesthesia had to be developed, and this required tremendous adventures in respiration, because the technique involved in anaesthesia for thoracic surgery required the cessation of respiration for the time of the operation, and this was a problem which involved the use of very powerful drugs and also complicated apparatus to keep the patient ventilated. This became simplified by the introduction of a drug called Curare. And this drug was being tried out in America in 1944-45. And in Liverpool, by a friend of mine in Liverpool, but I didn't know that at the time, but I had read in a journal that it was being used to paralyze muscle in certain situations. For example, it was helpful in electroconvulsive therapy. And I thought if we could get some and use it in thoracic anaesthesia in Mercers, that it would help our work, make our work very much simpler. And through the good offices of a government official who was able to, who was sent on official business to New York, he was able to literally have purloined from the Bellevue Hospital some of this curare, which he brought back to Dublin and was tried in Mercer's and used for Ireland, in Ireland for the first time. Now, this particular drug is a relaxant, has no anesthetic effect, but relaxes muscle. And it has actually revolutionized anesthetics all over the world, made modern surgery much more, much easier, and has also, of course, helped to reduce mortality and morbidity very considerably.
Not surprisingly, Mercer's outpatients department has had many unusual callers down through the years. Matron Anne Dunn.
I can remember at one stage as my sister remembering a gentleman. I never really got to know him. He didn't actually come into the hospital, but he used to pass the hospital many times. And he had he used to have a kilt. And I don't know where he had been one night, but he had an inflated dolphin that he was hugging. And there were some youths that used to come along, and they were trying to puncture the dolphin. And this was really something worth seeing. And these are the type of things that you'd see at night. But of course, mind you, it can be there can be sad things in the casualties at night. Maybe somebody having been gassed, brought in dead, and dealing with their relatives. And this is another very sad side of a hospital. And a part that nurses play a big role in. And of course, hospital surroundings at night, we are also very glad at times for the help that the local police can give us, whether it be finding the next of kin of patients or in any other area.
Poverty and loneliness would have been part of a city centre hospital like this too, wouldn't it?
Oh, very much so. I can remember one Christmas Eve night, a gentleman coming in with his wife, and she had slipped. And he was a rather old gentleman, you know, the type that would have a stiff round collar with a black tie and a nice coat, but it was almost threadbare, but a very clean gentleman. And it turned out that they had gone to church in the morning, which they weren't always able to go to because he was quite elderly, but they were able to get there that morning. But their Christmas dinner consisted of a beer and cheese sandwiches. And he had told me he had participated in the Dardanelles in the First War and had been invalided back to Mercer's in 1919. So, yes, there are lonely people and people that have had quite long connections with the hospital.
Now, oh, good gracious, I know this old place well. There's the door. I remember one night that we, after the hall porch went on, we had to answer the accident door. I remember I came down, and of course that's me thinking nothing of opening the door. And this old fellow brushed in past me, and he was raggedy looking, and he had a long old moustache and his bare feet, and he was standing on end. And he said, "I can't sleep." And I ran in, and I thought to myself the best thing to do was to get him something. I think it's 10 aspirins or the place here that they kept weak drugs, you know. So I got a few aspirins, and I said, "You take that, you go home, and you'll sleep." And he said, "Give it to me yourself." And he opened his mouth. Oh, good gracious, it was like throwing something into a volcano or something. And I said, "You'll sleep." And he snarled at me, and he said, I haven't slept for a fortnight since I left. Since I left Grange Gorman a fortnight ago, I haven't slept. And I thought I'd never get him out of the door like that. I nearly collapsed when I got him out. But that, I didn't come to the door again without somebody after that.
66 years later, that speaker, a former student nurse of Mercer's, searches for the stairway to the attic, known in her student days as Kate's Hole.
That's it, that's it, that's it. Yes, out from the kitchen. And I remember all those presses weren't there at all. If you left anything in the kitchen, Kate would throw them out on the ward. You know, if you forgot something, you went in to wash something and left a cup or something that you didn't dry, Kate would throw it out after you into the ward and scream after you. Oh, we're afraid of our lives.
Would you like to go up Kate's Hole? I'm sure it's very dirty.
Oh, I want to look up it anyhow.
Do you? Well, I'll have to get somebody to open it.
Ah, never mind.
No, we'll
so
get somebody to unlock
go
it.
Out, you could go out on top and across the parapet and into the dormitories on the other side, you know, in the window.
Yeah.
And the laundry was up there, I remember. Yeah. We went out there to dry our hair, you know.
To dry your hair?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, how else would you dry it after you wash your hair? You have to go out on the roof and dry it.
How indeed. And how did they find the money in those days to study nursing? Sister tutor Mary Moore.
In 1917, to enter nursing then, it was 50 guineas. Which was a lot of money in that time. And if any people who were less well off, who hadn't a lot of money at that time, would have found it very difficult to enter nursing because the students in their first year weren't given any salary at all. In their second year, they got £6, and in their third year, they received £12 per annum.
All found.
That's right.
Conditions. What did people think of the conditions of the day? Did they think they were hard done by?
Oh, they worked very hard. I think they were great people. Their hours of work, they worked from 7:30 a.m. in the morning until 8 p.m. in the evening. They had no day off at all. They had one day off per week, one half day off per week, I should say. The holidays, they only had 3 weeks, and they could only take those at set times. And in 1917, I believe they could only take them in June, July or August. At Christmas, they didn't get any time off at all. And the night duty, they worked 1 month on, and then after that, they went back straight onto day duty for 2 months and had to go back onto night duty again for another month. So I would think that was very hard work.
There were some very famous matrons, weren't there?
That's correct. Miss Keane was here in 1917. She married Sean Keating, I believe, the artist, and then Miss Burkett replaced her in 1920. Miss Burkett actually was a matron before Miss Keane here, and she left to go to World War I. And she returned with the Mons Medal, I believe. So Miss Gallagher informed me. And Sir John Lumsden spoke highly of Miss Burkett, and I think I should quote that he said that they were most fortunate in their nursing staff, and never in the history did he remember in having a better team, a matron in whom he had the greatest confidence. He had very good sisters, staff nurses, and he mentioned that he had most promising and hard-working probationers at that time. So even then, the staff were very, very good.
Much earlier, in 1738, within a few years of the hospital's founding, the medical staff at Mercer's were looking for improvements. They wanted a bath and a fluxing room. The following year, 1739, the trustees found a spot of ground adjoining the hospital, and a new wing was built, bringing the number of beds from 10 to 30. 17 years later, it was decided to rebuild the entire hospital, this time with 50 beds.
And when John Howard, the philanthropist, visited Ireland in 1783, he found Mercer's fresher and more agreeable than any of the other Dublin hospitals.
That was all on the same site, was it?
Yes, it has remained always on the same site. It is the, well, of course, Stephen's is the oldest hospital on the same, on the site that it was built, but Mercer's has always been on the on its original site. Like all institutions, it found itself very short of money, and in 1808 it was so heavily in debt that only half the beds were in use. But a few years later it was able to provide a garden at the back of the hospital, and then it acquired the buildings that the College of Surgeons had used, and so it was able to utilize those. I'm not quite sure when the present dome was added. It's such a striking thing, I think, and it's referred to by Oliver St. John Gogarty in As I Was Going Down Sackville Street, where he writes, "West against the sunset, the roofs of Mercer's shone," which I think is a nice description of how it catches your eye from a distance.
From the exterior landmark of the dome to what is Mercer's traditional timepiece dominating the entrance hall, we go on into the outpatients department.
You know, this morning is the last morning for Mr. Quilligan. You're going on to Patrick Dawn's from here.
Further again. Further again.
Further away.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you.
Take a seat over there now. Have you come back again, Paddy? Huh? Have you come back again?
No, I'm just saying I'm at Patrick Dawn's.
When?
In about 6 weeks, I'm filling the hospital.
Yeah, I'll give you the number.
Will you?
Yeah.
Thank you.
762-771. Barbara's home.
Are you going there? Oh, well, I'll make sure to be there.
Bring me out for a drink.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
No, Paddy.
Thank
that's
you.
That's the appointment number.
Yeah. Are you going there?
I'm not. I'm going to James's.
Oh. Well, I'll have to go to James's also.
You're following me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Paddy. Mind yourself.
The move is on. A move that was planned many years ago.
It was realised quite a long time ago, certainly as far back as 1920, that the way medicine was and surgery were developing, that it wouldn't be possible for any of the smaller hospitals to have all the facilities. And the disadvantages of the smaller hospitals were continually discussed. And in as far back as 1920, Robert Rowlett, who was one of the physicians to Mercer's, proposed that there would be an amalgamation of Mercer's, Dunn's, and the Royal City of Dublin Hospital in Bagot Street. In 1939, the Minister for Local Government and Public Health agreed to set aside $2.5 million as an endowment fund for this new hospital, which was to have 400 beds and possibly to be increased to 500 beds if a good case could be made for it.
Where was it to be located?
I'm not sure that a decision on that point had been made. It was held up, of course, by the war.
That plan was overtaken by a larger one enacted in 1971 to federate the Dublin Voluntary Hospitals. It was thought that they would all go under one roof at St. James's.
Everything seemed set when what might seem to be a political coup decided that that the next major hospital in Dublin should be at Beaumont in North Dublin.
And the move to St. James's was shelved once again until now.
You've spoken to me about any regrets about Mercer's closing. Yes, I think that it's by the nature of things and the development of the hospitals in Dublin, it would seem inevitable as one of the smaller hospitals in the city that it had to go, but nevertheless doesn't take away any more from the pain. I think it will be a great loss to certain parts of Dublin, and a lot of people will find it very hard to pass it and say that it no longer exists as a hospital. It brings back the memories, of course, of a lot of people who did so much for surgery and medicine in Dublin and the country. But altogether, I feel that it will be a loss to Dublin that it will be very hard to compensate for, and that certainly it will be something which most people will regret, if for no other reason than even though they may never have been inside the buildings, will have remembered as a great Georgian landmark in the city.
I would like to take this opportunity pointing out that St. James's Hospital is still well within the city limits and won't be any further away from the centre of the city than, say, the Mater Hospital. And we will still be a south city of Dublin hospital.
It's a very small hospital, this, 120 beds. So inevitably there has to be a kind of family atmosphere where literally everybody knows everybody else.
Yes, I think this is correct. A lot of people comment on this, the individual patient care. But then I think this is, as you say, due to the size of the hospital, but also to the modern trend of personalising care to patients. And I would hope that our staff will project this in their future roles in other hospitals.
Well, I think that it has, at all stages, exemplified good medicine based on first-class clinical science as it developed through the ages, or through the last 2.5 centuries, and that allied to that there was the spirit of charity, using that in its real sense, and that medicine was applied in a kind and well-mannered way to the people who came to the hospital. It was small and you knew the patients, and there was none of the impersonality that one so often hears about. I'm not sure that that is always justified. I think large institutions can be kind too, but I think certainly Mercer's has been a kind and well-mannered institution. But I think that if I was asked what is the outstanding thing about Mercer's that has struck me, I would say it's nursing. Its nursing has been superb.